Good morning. Time now for the regular roundup of war news from the far corners of the world. As we call in our on-the-scenes correspondents, we hear first from the land down under. Go ahead, Australia.
This is Mountain Grosky calling from Sydney. Today I visited an American army camp somewhere in Australia. It was a pleasant place with plenty of room, lots of grass, and a great fence all around. At the gate stood three of our soldiers, looking from a distance, very sinister in their new olive-drab German-type helmet. But from nearby, with their young, pleasant American faces, looking not at all tough or warlike. All in all, they were fighting pretty big odds and trying to look military for a flock of Australian kids crowded around them, not a bit frightened by the helmets, the rifles, or the half-hearted attempt to shoo them off with warnings that their mothers were looking for them. There was nothing unmilitary about the snappy salute I received as I walked past the gate, however, and the camp itself was spick and span with every little thing in apple pie order. I got permission from the officer in charge to speak with a man. And a little private named Joe Murray from Lebanon, Pennsylvania, volunteered to show me around. Joe was pretty small, only about 5'6", and didn't look a day over 18. He swore to me that he was 21, however, and said, "That's old enough to be in this man's army." Joe said he used to work in an army canteen before he joined the army, and enlisted instead of waiting for the draft. I said, "How come you enlisted, Joe?" And he said, "Well, they would have drafted me anyway, and what's more, I don't like the little yellow monkey." Joe took me first to a group lying about on the grass under a gum tree. Two of them were playing mumbly peg with their penknives, and the rest were lying on their backs looking at the sky and mostly complaining about the heat. I sat down with them and asked the nearest, Vincenzo Ambrosino, who came from Gloversville, New York, how he liked Australia and the army. Vincenzo said the army was all right, and as far as he could see, the only thing wrong with Australia was that you couldn't get a decent cup of coffee. Everybody got interested when Vincenzo mentioned coffee, and I was bombarded with pleas to tell him at home to, for God's sake, send some coffee and send it quick. Staff Sergeant John Masick of Dorothy, New Jersey, had a few words to say on the subject of coffee as compared to tea. According to John, there ought to be a law about this tea business. "What do you think they send around to the sergeant's mess this morning for breakfast?" John asked me indignantly. "Tea. So help me, these guys send around tea. And in the morning... Honest, we was all fit to be tied. See, they send us. Well, you couldn't even shave in it." "And that ain't nothing," John continued. "Tea for breakfast ain't bad enough, but they gotta go and give us tea for dinner, too." The rest of the group then took the words out of John's mouth and informed me that supper brought the hated tea again. Joe interrupted then to say, "Come on. These guys don't worry about nothing but their stomach. Let me show you the rest of the place." We moved on to another group who were sitting on the grass, swapping stories with a couple of Australian soldiers, veterans of the Libyan campaign. The Aussies got as good as they gave. For every 100 Germans the Australians captured in the desert, one of our soldiers casually sank a German submarine in the Atlantic. For every desert sandstorm the Australians produced, we turned up a terrific storm at sea. On the grass all over the great encampment sat similar groups of Americans, talking of home, swapping stories about their girls, wishing for letters from home, kicking about the food, wondering when they were going to go into action, wondering how they'd behave when they finally were in action. As I walked among them, I was pleased with what I saw. They were clean and well set up and fit. They were well dressed and neat. Our soldiers had the best uniforms of any army in the world. The cloth of good strong cern, the boots, tough, well-tanned leather. Every bit of equipment, from canvas leggings to munition webbing and revolver holsters, is strongly built and of good material. I find it hard to believe the articles I read in American magazines and papers about low army morale some months ago. These men want to fight and feel they have something worth fighting for. I think little Joe, who took me around, is fairly typical of the rest. When he left me at the gate at the end of the day, he said, "Listen, you know what I said about enlisting because I knew I'd be drafted anyway?" I said, "Yes, Joe." "Well, it's more than that," Joe said. "I got pretty sore about what them Japs did at Pearl Harbor. I guess I really joined up so they wouldn't ever be able to do that at home." This is Mark McGronsky returning you now to San Francisco.
From San Francisco, we take you now across the continent to the newsroom in New York.
Now from New York, we have a report that comes from Moscow that says that strong Russian wedges have driven into German lines between Rzhev and Staraya Russa on the front northwest of the capital. Fierce Nazi counterattacks to relieve the entrapped 16th German Army at Staraya Russa are said to have been smashed with heavy German losses. On the muddy southern front, Red Army units are said to have retaken 10 more towns in recent fighting. Lord Beaverbrook, the British Lend-Lease representative to the United States, declares that the Russian battlefront is the most critical in the history of civilization. Lord Beaverbrook spoke over the Canadian radio network. He declared the hopes of humanity are centered on the Russian front and urged that supplies be rushed to the Red Army. New Delhi, India, a spearhead of thousands of Japanese invaders, has finally clashed with the British in western Burma. And now vicious fighting rages on the road to Prome, the gateway to Burma's great oil fields to the north. This is not just a skirmish in the jungle, for the British announced that their tanks have joined the battle. Now we leave the New York newsroom and switch to our reporter in London, England.
This is London. John McVane speaking. British bombers last night attacked shipping off the Norwegian coast. Military quarters in London believe the Chinese forces are still holding out in Tonggu in spite of fierce Japanese attacks. It's thought the Japanese on the Irrawaddy front are advancing in three columns on both banks of the river and along the Prome Road. The commando raid on the important German naval base at Saint-Nazaire has had a refreshing effect on the way the ordinary Britisher thinks about the war. The dash and daring of the raid are linked with the fact that the commando smash seems to have done considerable damage to the port, one of the U-boat nests that threatened shipping all over the Atlantic. The attack was in the tradition of Drake and Essex, and that's the sort of tradition the British like to think about. It's being pointed out here that the destroyer Campbelltown, loaded with explosive, jammed herself right into the lock entrance as far as her bridge, and the enemy couldn't possibly have moved her before the explosion. The Times expresses the belief that the main entrance lock is out of action for many months, and there's some hope here that the torpedo attack may have crippled the U-boat entrance as well. It's emphasized in London that more important damage could be done by landing parties than by repeated bomber raids in the port. The German claim to have killed or taken prisoner 400 men is said to be a gross exaggeration. It's said that 100 would probably be an overstatement, and that's a small price to pay. The Germans themselves said the town wasn't in their hands until 8 in the morning, several hours after the expedition had left. And the evident German confusion about the whole business is regarded here as one of the most reassuring factors. I've been talking with a Frenchman who's just been in both occupied and unoccupied France. He said the Saint-Nazaire exploit will have a heartening effect on the French people. He said that although the Germans will try to belittle the raid, the rumors by now will have flashed all over France, and pretty quickly the word will spread that the British held the town not for a few hours, but for several days. The government's proposals to the Indian states are regarded in Britain as fair suggestions based on sound common sense. British commentators today emphasize that India is being granted her chance. How she will respond depends on the decisions that the various groups of Indian leaders take. But the general hope in Britain is that they'll realize that the autonomy they've been demanding depends on whether they can unite in the face of a common threat. Sections of British opinion who have long asked for a square deal for India think that Sir Stafford Cripps' proposals are just about everything that had been hoped for. The Liberal News Chronicle points out that there are no reservations and no stipulations, except the safeguarding of the rights of minorities. And the News Chronicle says the protection of minorities has long been a recognized part of the obligations of enlightened government. This is John McVane in London, returning you to New York.
Now, once again in our New York newsroom, a story from New Delhi. A historic broadcast is scheduled tonight for the people of India. Sir Stafford Cripps will take the microphone in New Delhi to explain the British proposals for Indian self-rule. These proposals are only tentative so far. Before they can be crystallized into actual British policy, they must meet with what Cripps calls sufficiently general and favorable acceptance from various sections of Indian opinion. That's why the New Delhi broadcast tonight is important. Sir Stafford himself has declared that the Indians have a choice of all or nothing. As he puts it, the scheme goes through as a whole or is rejected as a whole. Britain is offering Indian dominion status, such as Canada and Australia enjoy in the British Empire. But states or provinces not wanting to join could adopt separate constitutions as dominions, and one or all would have the right to secede from the empire if they chose. The plan apparently represents the maximum concessions Prime Minister Churchill's dominant British Conservatives are willing to make from London. It would not go into effect until after the war. Now we turn to the nation's capital for the report of Earl Godwin from the newsroom in Washington.
And good morning, folks. First thing this morning, Senator Burton K. Wheeler, the fighting Democrat from Montana, charges that powerful interests injure the war effort by stopping or blocking synthetic rubber development and retarding the manufacture of industrial alcohol from farm products, and that is widespread in its interest. Evidence that comes to me, says Wheeler, that Fraser Moffat, director of the alcohol division of the War Production Board, is one of those also connected with the Industrial Alcohol Trust, and that he has attempted to prevent building of plants and factories for the purpose of converting surplus grain into industrial alcohol. And Wheeler goes on to say that the Alcohol Trust, as he calls it, prefers to use blackstrap molasses, which means using cane sugar right in the midst of a sugar shortage. Some big oil companies, goes on Wheeler to say, also want to make industrial alcohol out of gas rather than farm products, and that's going to cause a row. And here's Martin Dies again, chairman of the Un-American Affairs Committee of the House, tangling with Vice President Wallace, and Congress has before it the makings of a good row, red hot, that may equal the explosion of the civilian defense actors, dancers, and ping-pong ball experts. Dies gives Vice President Wallace a list of 35 communists, or fellow travelers, according to Dies, working for big and moderate pay and planning great post-war changes, all of them on the payroll of the Board of Economic Warfare, which is headed by Vice President Wallace. The leading target of the Dies charge this morning is a man named Maurice Parmalee, who is the head economist of this board. Dies goes back a few years and takes up a book, and he quotes from Parmalee's book on nudism, which has 300 photographs from life in a nudist camp in Europe, and declares that Parmalee has advocated nudism in the home, in the office, and in the factory. There are a great many other statements and quotes. Dies wants to know, as he lists a score or more of what he calls communists or crackpots or fellow travelers, how come the Board of Economic Warfare to choose these revolutionaries when there are so many common-sense persons of vast ability who could be obtained to do the same job? Among the quotes, Parmalee in his book says he's not too sure that the American people will go completely nude in home, office, and factory. And the quotation Parmalee makes himself is this: the church and its clergy are usually strongly entrenched in the country and exercise a powerful sway over its inhabitants, end of quote. Mr. Wallace comes back with a crack at Dies, saying that his statement, is the product of a witchcraft mind, and that Dies would be less dangerous if he were right on Gable's payroll. But Dies touches on a subject on which a large section of Congress will respond immediately. It may not amount to a thing, but a drive starts already now to rid the Board of Economic Welfare of these men on whom Dies puts the finger. The Senate shows signs of breaking out again, too. While the House takes a 2 weeks rest, meeting simply from day to day to keep the record straight, and the Senate will hear through the Naval Affairs Committee, probably today, a first-hand report on the American campaign against submarines on the Atlantic coast. Senator Pepper calls on Congress to give the government full authority to seize all facilities and everything needed in the war effort, and he soon will produce a bill for general mobilization of everybody. The same time, Pepper is accused by certain Florida interests of being a sort of a dog in the manger in potential sugar production in Florida. Seems to be a row between Pepper and the big sugar outfit in Florida. And in the meantime, Florida's sugar capacity, it is so reported here, is not being used to anywhere near its capacity. And that's all from Washington at this time.
Thank you, Earl Godwin. Heard on this early morning roundup of news here and abroad this morning were John McVane from London, Martin Agronsky from Sydney, Australia, Earl Godwin from Washington, and the newsroom in New York. For the latest news, keep tuned to this station.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.